to introduce Warren Young. It says here, Warren, that you were appointed a full-time law commissioner for a term of 3 years in May 2004, so presumably you're currently unemployed.
Well, it's been extended.
Extended, right. and deputy president from May 2005. Prior to that, he was Deputy Secretary for Justice for 4 years, and before that, of course, he was Director of the Institute of Criminology and then Professor of Law at Victoria University and Assistant Vice-Chancellor of Research for 5 years. He has been a Fulbright Fellow in 1985 and a co-author of Adams on Criminal Law, which I have to say I have not read a line of. But without further ado, Warren Young. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, and I must say I'd be astonished if Frank had read a line of Adams on Criminal Law. It's my great pleasure to be here, and I'm delighted that we have such a good audience here. I should really just begin by saying that although this seminar is co-hosted by Internet New Zealand and the Law Commission and the Ministry of Justice, it really is Internet New Zealand that's done all the work, and so I really should thank Jordan Carter and David Farrer for taking the initiative in doing this and for really doing all of the planning and organisation. And I think the way the event has run to date is a demonstration of what excellent organisation they've done. I'm going to talk about the Law Commission report on suppressing names and evidence that we did touch on this morning. Very much as an introduction, I think, to Judge Harvey's presentation, which will be much more particularly about the implications of the internet for suppression. I want to really just go through very quickly and summarise what our report says in some selected areas and then raise some key issues for discussion. So I will be relatively brief because I really would like to hear from you rather than you hear from me. Clearly, we would like feedback and views on what we have recommended and our views on the issues that I intend to raise. As a starting point, I think I should begin by spelling out the principle that governed the way in which we approach the task. And I don't think the way we approach this task is at all at odds with what anyone said this morning. And that is that we should begin with the starting proposition that we have a system of open justice. As a general rule, the courts must conduct their business in public unless that would result in injustice. Trials should therefore be open to the public and those who attend proceedings have a right to report those proceedings to others. And that, of course, is consistent with the right to freedom of expression in Section 14 of the Bill of Rights Act. It's obviously in accordance with what we all accept as a pretty fundamental element of a democratic society. No one in making submissions on our issues paper really disagreed with that open justice principle, or indeed the way in which we had expressed it. And I'd have to say, no one really disagreed either with the main exception that we made to that, which is that the chief object of the courts must be to secure justice. Sometimes doing justice in public would frustrate justice itself, and where it does, then that justifies some limits on freedom of expression and publicising what goes on in the courts. And obviously the main but not the only aspect of that is the right to a fair trial. Tony Smith, I think, raised the issue this morning whether that is an absolute right or should be qualified in some way. I guess I would probably say that I think that it is more or less an absolute right, but as I will come on to show shortly, the real issue there is about what threshold you want to put. When do you regard the right to a fair trial as jeopardised? We ended up with adopting the real risk test, which is the present test. Some argued for a slightly higher threshold than that. But whatever view you take of that, it does seem to me that the principle of open justice does mean that the exception there needs to be cautiously applied. In other words, before we limit freedom to expression and the right to publicise what goes on in the courts, we need to be pretty sure that, in fact, it does jeopardise what is required for justice. And that, of course, really is consistent with the approach taken by the Bill of Rights Act, because you can only actually infringe a right in the Bill of Rights Act, or limit it, rather, if that's actually demonstrably justified in a free and democratic society. It's not enough, as it were, to say it might. So with that introductory remark, let me just summarise what the report covers. Much more than simply suppression of name and evidence. Those are two key elements of the report. But clearly we also look at names and identifying particulars of victims, witnesses and others. We look at what the grounds for closing the court should be, if ever. Issues around jurisdiction, appeals and orders, publication on the internet, and we also look at contempt offences and penalties, although we do leave contempt to be dealt with on another day. Not today, but another day. What I do intend to do today is just very briefly go through what we recommended in relation to the first of those two, suppression of evidence and suppression of the name or identifying particulars of accused or convicted persons. If anyone wants further detail on the rest, happy to provide that. In relation to evidence, the current law is in section 138 of the Criminal Justice Act. I've set that out at the top of the slide there. The court may forbid publication where it's of the opinion it's required in the interest of justice, public morality, the reputation of any victim of an alleged sexual offence or offence of extortion, or the security or defence of New Zealand. We went through all of those grounds and decided what we thought the grounds ought to be, and have made quite a number of recommendations for change. We think that the court should only be able to suppress evidence or submissions where it's satisfied that, first of all, the interests of security or defence of New Zealand require, which no one really had any quibble with, where there is a real risk of prejudice to a fair trial. We did, as I said before, reject the view that we should have some test like substantial or high risk. We thought that as long as there are real risk, that should be enough. But real risk really probably is something a little more than a very remote risk. Thirdly, the order is necessary to avoid undue hardship to victims. We decided that there was no need to single out alleged sexual offences or offences of extortion, that an undue hardship to victims test across the board was enough to cover that. Again, very few people, I think, quibbled with the view that there ought to be that protection in place. Fourthly, that publication would endanger the safety of any person. Fifthly, that publication would be likely to prejudice the interests of the maintenance of the law. And that's things like the investigation of future offending, the investigation or arrest of co-offenders, that sort of thing. Now, there's two points, I think, to note about that list of things that we regard as sufficient to justify suppression. First of all, there is no longer a broad interest of justice test. That's quite deliberate. It is something that I don't think all members of the judiciary are happy with, because an interest of justice test is one that gives judges lots and lots of discretion. We took the view that, in fact, we ought to be explicit in spelling out what the grounds for suppression ought to be, and that as long as we have been as comprehensive as we can be about that, there is no need for a catch-all. And I think part of the problem with the catch-all is that it allows idiosyncratic judicial decisions. As one judge said to me once, the interest of justice is whatever the judge feels like on the day. And in relation to suppression, I think there is an element of truth in that. Certainly, I think a lot of the concerns there's been around suppression in recent years has not been so much about the law, but about the decisions that happen to have been made in individual cases. That's evidence. In relation to the names of accused and convicted people, the current power to suppress name is contained in Section 140 of the Criminal Justice Act. It is a broad judicial discretion with no specific statutory criteria. Therein lies part of the problem. Our report recommends that we specify the grounds in legislation with a fair degree of particularity. Again, I've set out the grounds that we recommend there. There are seven of them. Again, real risk of prejudice to a fair trial, prevent undue hardship to victims. The third ground that I've listed there I should make some comment on, though. We have said in relation to the accused and persons connected to the accused that there should only be grounds for suppressing the name of the accused if it will result in extreme hardship. I think in our issues paper we did moot whether that should be simply an undue hardship test, but we're in the end satisfied that the threshold ought to be a higher one. Where publication would endanger the safety of any person, where it would identify another person whose name is suppressed, where it would prejudice the interest of the maintenance of law again, or where it would cast suspicion on other people. So again, note there that there is no broad interest of justice test. We have been comprehensive in spelling out the grounds. We have said that where it is simply hardship to the accused, that extreme hardship will be required. And certainly I would expect that the result of that, if it were implemented, would be that suppression of name would occur somewhat less frequently than is currently the case, at least in terms of substantial periods of time. That's an issue I'll come on to shortly. So that's a very brief summary of where we got to on those two issues. Let me run through what I think are some of the issues that arise out of that I'd really actually quite value discussion and feedback on. The first is the issue of celebrities. And I partly put that as number one because the New Zealand Herald seems to be running a bit of a campaign against our report at the moment in the light of a couple of recent cases involving celebrities and suggesting that our report is inadequate because it doesn't address the problem of celebrities. The key issue, of course, is whether the fact that publication might have a greater effect on well-known people should affect whether suppression is granted. The leading case on that, Lewis and Wilton and Horton, says that the standing of the accused is not in itself grounds for suppression in the absence of evidence of special harm through publicity. Our report said much the same thing. That is, we said celebrity in itself seems to be more or less to go without saying, but celebrity in itself should not be a ground for name suppression. But of course, the extent to which a person is well known, the extent to which they have a good reputation, and so on and so forth, may well be relevant along with a whole host of other things in determining whether or not there is extreme hardship. The New Zealand Herald seems to have taken the stance in recent days that what we need to be doing is to have a law that prevents the suppression of the names of celebrities, and they seem to have got some support for that proposition, which I do regard as a somewhat peculiar proposition. Not quite sure how we define who a celebrity is, but if you've got any views on that, I'd be interested to hear. But also it does seem to me that it's somewhat strange. In order to address what they somehow see as the courts giving preference to a special class of people who do get suppression, to create a special class of people who can't get suppression. And there is a little bit of a contradiction in that, which, if I get the opportunity, I might draw to the attention of an editor of the New Zealand Herald. We think that there is a real issue around equality before the law. Everyone ought to be able to get suppression on the same grounds. And the information that is relevant to those grounds ought to be able to be taken into account. So if someone can make out a case for suffering extreme hardship, then of course they should be able to do so. And I should just make the point there, actually, that inevitably that means that reputation and standing will play a part in suppression decisions. An accused person who has 100 previous convictions and has been in prison for 10 of the last 12 years doesn't actually suffer anything from getting publicity about the prosecution. And therefore, inevitably, of course, lack of reputation plays a role in those decisions, and the converse equally applies. So that's issue number one. Issue number two is interim name suppression and the extent to which the rules ought to be a little different for interim name suppression. Now, I should just explain that I think one of the reasons why we've had a problem with judges appearing to grant name suppression too readily is very often simply because of the way list courts operate with accused people at first appearance. They are busy list courts. They often have lists of 70 or 100 people appearing on the day. Judges don't have time to deal with arguments of name suppression. Accused people don't actually necessarily have anyone representing them at that point other than the duty solicitor, who has about 2 minutes to get instructions from them. And therefore, when confronted with a request for name suppression, the easiest thing for the judge to do is simply to move on to the next case and not be held up till 7 o'clock at night still in court, is to grant the interim suppression and move on. And the danger, of course, is that that simply rolls on from one appearance to the next, because at the next list court, the judge is in the same position and doesn't have the opportunity to deal with it in depth either. A process, in our view, is required to preserve the court's ability to suppress name where that's justified, when more information is available, but at the same time to avoid interim orders rolling on indefinitely. So we have recommended that on first appearance, an accused should be entitled to an interim order if he or she advances an arguable case for suppression, but that order should always expire at the next appearance and should not be renewed unless evidence, and that generally would be supporting evidence of some sort from others, is produced. And if that sort of regime is put in place, then I guess we would expect that the outcome of that would be that name suppression at first appearance is actually pretty easy to get, but at second appearance, which is generally a fortnight or so later, and from then on, interim suppression ought to be pretty difficult to get, and certainly won't be able to be obtained unless there is good supporting evidence. Third and related issue is whether the rules governing suppression should be different pre- and post-conviction. Should a different standard apply before, during, or after trial? Now, clearly the argument that it should is simply an argument that mud sticks. Before trial, publication of the name of the accused may result in irreparable harm to reputation, and if they're acquitted, then that damage will still carry on. And therefore, there ought to be greater room for name suppression before the accused has had the chance to put his or her case in court. The view we took on that was that that is not an argument in itself for greater limits on open justice pre-trial. No different test is required, But clearly the stage of the trial can be taken into account in determining whether or not the test is met, particularly in relation to extreme hardship. It will obviously be much more difficult to satisfy a test of extreme hardship after you have been convicted than before. Issue four is futility, an issue that we had a lot of discussion about this morning. The general view that seemed to have come through in some comments this morning, although in a rather ambivalent way. I mean, I know Robert said that the horse is bolted, but at the same time wanted to ensure you retained the rules around name suppression and had offences to cover them, and I can't quite reconcile those two things. But it seems to me that the futility argument, the view that the horse is bolted, and I didn't say anything about this morning because I had my opportunity now, is simply an overstated case. The horse hasn't bolted. Of course, it is now more difficult to enforce suppression orders. More people now know. But the view that everyone knows, I just do not accept. The view, indeed, that everyone knows who the name of the recent celebrity is, I do not accept. Of course, the PM knows, but he has rather more resources at his disposal than the rest of us, as I think Stephen said in his blog. There were hundreds of final orders for name suppression last year. Were all of them really futile? And even if, in fact, a large number of people, even most people, found out about the order for name suppression, I still find the futility argument a rather peculiar one. I mean, it sort of strikes me by way of analogy that it's similar to saying there's lots and lots of shoplifting around, so we really should just flag it away and make it lawful because, really, we're never going to get on top of this. Well, of course we never get on top of shoplifting. We only detect a tiny, tiny fraction of it, but I don't hear anyone therefore arguing that we really should simply give up because it's not worth us. Issue number five is the internet, the one, of course, that we're really here to discuss, the challenges posed by the internet that is related to the futility argument. Information is constantly available. It retains its fresh quality. It is much easier to go back and get it. Therefore, information loses its practical and partial obscurity. How do we respond to that? What we recommended in our report is that where a suppression order is breached by publication on the internet, there should be a statutory obligation on service providers or content hosts to remove or block access to that material. The intent of that recommendation was to relate it only to locally hosted content rather than information hosted offshore. The recommendation wasn't expressed as well as it might have been, as a result of which it did, I think, create some ambiguity and misunderstanding. We said that the ISP must become aware, by which we mean know, that the information is in breach of the order. The requirement is to remove it if you're the host or block it as soon as reasonably practicable. We'd be interested, of course, in a discussion about whether that is practicable and what the difficulties with it are. But I suppose also, just to conclude, I would raise a question there about whether that is enough, and I'm not saying that it isn't enough. I think it is worth having a debate about. Our proposal is restricted to locally hosted material. There was clearly a very strong view from the internet community that it would be totally unjustified to go further than the narrow interpretation of what we were recommending. I think that at least there ought to be a debate about whether we should or could block information that is hosted on overseas sites. But clearly there is first of all the technological issue about whether you can do that simply isolating the particular piece of information that is subject to a suppression order. If not, then there would clearly be major problems in doing that. But the argument in one direction, obviously, is that it's not unlawful for the information to be held in an overseas jurisdiction, so it's unlawful to block access on the internet to material that is in fact lawfully held. The opposing argument is obviously that it's suppressed material. People, if they are able to simply put suppressed material from New Zealand onto overseas sites, will do that. People in New Zealand should not be able to use the internet to subvert New Zealand court processes. In the end, people may well say that is unrealistic. The horse has well and truly bolted on that one. It's too difficult and we ought not to try. And I wouldn't want to argue against that proposition, but I'd be interested in views. Thanks very much.
Obviously, there are going to be some questions and perhaps some suggestions. I think you were first, and then Stephen. Oh, there, Campbell. Please remember to introduce yourself.
I think it's important I do introduce myself in this case. I'm Paul Smith from the New Zealand Herald. and you're in fine company with the blogger Russell Brown, who declared last week on Media 7 that we're running a campaign on that issue. There is no campaign, I can assure you. What there was really just coverage and debate of the news. And I'll probably just make a comment rather than the question, as you brought it up earlier. And what we were doing there is following on from the Prime Minister saying that he knew who the profile, who the entertainer was really brings back to a point on your slide that you you brought up about everyone knows really. And what we wanted to know was, does everyone know? And pretty much if you read the stuff and looked at the video, everyone probably who was under about the age of 30 did know. And everyone who was over 30 probably didn't. And I think that probably, for those of us who know what case I'm talking about, made its own point. Thank you.
Just reply to that point, because I asked my privacy class, which has got about 85 people in it, who are all under 30, most of them around 20, exactly the demographic who should know the name. In fact, the two of us teach the class and we both separately asked the question, but when I asked them, about 90% knew. And I thought, oh, that's interesting and not surprising. But then I said, actually, did Nicole ask you that? And they said, yeah, we've already been asked that. And then I said, well, how many people knew when she asked a week ago? And it was about a third. And it wasn't that the others couldn't know, it's just they hadn't bothered. I do think that there's a danger that journalists will think just because they know and all their friends know and all the people they talk to know, everybody does. What I usually do is phone my mum, and she's in Tauranga, you know, reasonably well connected, quite interested in these sorts of things. Sometimes she knows, sometimes she doesn't. Anyway, my question is it possible that ISPs are currently liable under contempt laws or under name suppression offences once they are told that the material on a blog that they're hosting is in breach of a name suppression order or contains material that's contempt?
Well, that's a very good question, and I couldn't speak. You're asking me for a legal opinion off the top of my head, Stephen. I don't know the answer to that question, although I guess I would have thought that there was an argument that the ISP isn't actually... In that case, they're a conduit, but they're not doing anything active. They may know about it, but they're simply a conduit for the information by others. So contempt would generally require an act rather than an omission. What act has the ISP actually done to contribute towards the contempt? But I'd have to think about that. Anyone? Judge.
Yeah, I'll answer the question later.
Right.
We'll just go back to Stephen's point about the asking his question of under 30. Is this on?
It's not on. His class of under 30 students, the question I would have asked is how many care? Anyway.
There's a guy appeared before me.
at one stage during the proceedings, the place was absolutely full of media. I couldn't understand what the interest was. It certainly wasn't. It wasn't me. And the guy got into the dock, rather nondescript-looking individual, and the papers started rustling and the cameras started whirling and so on and so forth. And I thought, who the hell is this guy? But then I'm over 60 and don't know much about modern technology, so I guess I fall into that outside the demographic.
Yeah, indeed. There's a question over here. Jordan, can you bring the mic over?
I'm a hobbit, a blogger, and I actually asked someone today, two people today in this room, who are both under 30, if they knew who that musician was, and they both said they didn't. So it's not true that everyone under 30 knows who this musician is. But in saying that, one of the things I'd like to point out, you talked about breach by publication. Now, it seems to me there's two ways of doing this. One is by publishing the person's name. That's a blatant breach. And the other one is by information that leads to the identification of such a person. And that could be like, for example, using this particular person as an example, the date of the assault, the town where he lived, the town where the assault was, the night of the concert that he appeared in, and all that information, plus more, was in one newspaper article. And it was very easy to find out who that person was just by that information. Now, would you include that sort of information as breach by publication? And if so, would that be treated any differently by the courts to a person's name?
Well, let me answer that in two parts. First of all, yes, I would definitely regard that as a breach, and I think so would any court. And that's why the recommendation is clearly around name or identifying particulars. But the second part of the answer to that is that one of the other issues that we discuss in the report is what to do about what is sometimes described as jigsaw identification, which is obviously not where that particular newspaper gives all of that information, but each one or each blog adds to what previously appeared, and when you put them all together, then it's perfectly apparent who the doctor is in town, because when you put it all together, there isn't anyone left. And I mean, it does seem to us in the end that if that is being done deliberately, and if you can actually see a pattern, and if actually the person who's providing the information actually knows that along with all the other information, that will lead to identification, that is also clearly enough to breach the order as well. But obviously there's going to be some difficulty in those cases in actually proving knowledge.
The gentleman here and then Bernard back then. And then David.
Robert Stewart, I'm a lawyer. And I think, Warren, that your last point really begs the question in relation to proving knowledge, because certainly I would have thought that for the prosecution, who has to prove these breaches beyond reasonable doubt, that that's going to be one of their biggest stumbling blocks, is actually establishing that knowledge. And then if you look what type of offence we're talking about, which is a strict liability offence, and I'll venture into dangerous territory by proffering an opinion in relation to Stephen's question, but if it's a strict liability offence, then the only way you can escape liability is showing that you've taken all practical steps to avoid the commission of the offence. So what does that mean? Does that mean that you as a blogger have to go around and actually search every other blog site to see what facts are already in the blogosphere before you add your little fact, which could be the one which joins all the dots? So I think there are some real issues there for the enforcement agencies, and being as I am a media lawyer, there's plenty of room there for me to explore that, the outer reaches of the universe, if you like, for my client.
Yeah. I totally agree with that and think that's a difficulty, and it's probably worth adding too, for those who don't know, if it's a strict liability offence too, there's a reverse onus on the defence to prove on the balance of probabilities that you actually had no fault. So the prosecution doesn't have to prove that you had the state of mind, you have to prove you didn't. And that, I think, does create difficulties in this context. It really does mean that there is, in theory, quite a significant onus on individual bloggers or sections of the media to see what everyone else is doing and saying. In practice, of course, it doesn't really work out like that.
That was next. There was comment made about shoplifting and how it still goes on, but we still try to police it. I wonder if there is a problem here, given that it may not be 100% who know the name of the entertainer, but a large proportion do, that the court system itself becomes scandalised in that its reputation is undermined by the fact that just about everyone now, when they hear the word name suppression, looks for a detail and goes to Google, so that the reputation of the court itself is damaged by this obsession now with finding out the names as if it's a game. I wonder if continuing to try to aggressively police name suppression actually damages the reputation of the court in the long run.
Well, I guess I'd be interested in other views on that. I think my answer would be no, because first of all, probably reflects my age as well. I'm not sure everyone does every time they hear the fact that a name's been suppressed, rush to Google to see who it is. Yes, a significant proportion of the population is, but I have no idea what that proportion is. And secondly, actually, as I said, there are hundreds and hundreds of suppression orders every year in relation to a whole variety of people. What we tend to do is to get obsessed about the individual celebrities that the media get obsessed by, and then use that as a case for saying the whole system doesn't work and the whole system is scandalised. And that seems to me to be a long bow, frankly.
Isn't it a danger, though, that the legal system is made to look a fool in the eyes of a large chunk of the population?
Well, I mean, the system's not made to look a fool because we detect 0.1 or 0.01% of shoplifting. We accept that we can't generally do it, but every now and again we will. We don't say, goodness me, the system's made to look a fool because people can generally get away with shoplifting. We accept that it's actually a very easy thing to do and that generally people won't be detected. Well, so?
Most citizens actually do believe in and adhere to the rule of law. That's what it's about.
But the danger,
and your suggestion would be, well, you know, why not just ditch the rule of law? Okay, go for your life. I love anarchy.
But isn't this the same argument that publishers of music and video are saying that they're essentially trying to put the genie back in the bottle when they're now seen widely as a bit of a joke?
Yeah, and they nearly got there with Section 92A, didn't they?
Okay, I think the point is well made, but we need to move on. David?
Thanks for the clarification, Warren, on the internet recommendation, which, as I read it, you're really saying that you're looking for an ISP to remove material on their network rather than block material. And I think that will be useful with that clarification.
Yep,
I don't think it's unreasonable that if an ISP is told it has suppressed material, or not so much, ISP is probably the wrong word. I actually think the word is a content host. It's not about the people who provide the connection. It's if they're hosting the material. What, though, I'd also like clarification on, and you may deal with this in your detailed drafting, is who should a host act on a notification from? Because I often get approached by quite insane people making allegations about they've got court orders, this and that, etc. And personally, I'd be of the view that you should only have an obligation to remove the material if it's someone from I would say, a government department or Crown Law or on behalf of a judge saying this is suppressed, or perhaps that can be solved by the Register of Suppression. But if you just have a general thing saying if it's suppressed, it has to be removed, most people who host don't actually know what is or is not suppressed, and don't necessarily have the ability to find out. So it would be useful to see if it should be that you have to do it on the basis of someone official.
That's a very good question, and I think it's a bit more than a drafting point, and it's something that we will need to talk about, because I mean, I certainly agree with you that you shouldn't have an obligation to remove it simply because somebody comes along and tells you that the material's suppressed. But the issue is whether you actually ought, if you're alerted to the fact that it is suppressed material, be under an obligation to go and find out. You know, so that if you actually simply say, well, you know, in other words, the equivalent of willful blindness, well, I've heard what you said, but I'm going to shut my eyes and I don't want to know any more about it, then I guess personally I would still regard the offence as needing to cover that.
Okay, thank you. Yeah. Can I just ask how many more people want to raise questions this time? We'll take those two and then we'll move on. But there is, of course, a discussion period afterwards. So microphone over here and then over with Robert.
I'm Amelia Evans from, I'm a judge's clerk at the Court of Appeal. I'm going to suggest something that's maybe going against the grain of what everyone's talking about. I'm interested in the interim suppression recommendation. My understanding was that in a report around 2004 on the visions of the courts, the Law Commission recommended interim suppression for everybody until they went to trial. And that's obviously not the position being adopted now. I can see some arguments for that in terms of simplicity. Everybody knows not to talk about anybody until it comes to trial. Decreases the likelihood of jurors being able to Google and actually get information about people who are being prosecuted. Gives everybody a chance to defend their reputation until all the evidence is on the table. So I'm just interested about why that view has been changed.
The Law Commission did make that recommendation, and it's 2000 report on structure of the court, delivering justice for all, the structure of the court's report. And that was a recommendation that really we reverted to the position that was briefly in force back in 1975, that I think somebody indicated before was enormously problematic in practice. I mean, obviously, one reason simply why we no longer share that view is because it's a different commission. The personnel have changed, and therefore views of what the appropriate position is have changed. And I suppose in the end too, although I have, you know, some sympathy for the view that pre-conviction people, you know, are presumed innocent and publicity in fact may harm their reputation, there is nothing in the fact that somebody has been charged that says they are guilty. And the fact that they have been charged is, on the opposing view, an argument that unless there's some exceptional reason otherwise, the community has a right to know about. In other words, the community has a right to know who the state is bringing proceedings against and why, because actually that's part of the state apparatus, and it's actually important that there be public scrutiny of that, not only so that people know who are the alleged offenders, but also so that people know who the state is acting against. And if you sort of think about it in the other, you know, in the other way, in a society unlike ours, if there were lots of people being prosecuted for political protest reasons, then actually the people who are being prosecuted and what they're being prosecuted for, we would want to be out in the open. So we knew the way in which the state was exercising its political power. And if you think about it through that lens, I think it explains sort of the reason why it's important that you have all of that information generally available.
Presumably,
take point.
Okay, last word was Robert. Well, second last word, because there's a lot of reply for us.
Just carrying on about interim name suppression, the case of Liddell, remember, was a school teacher from an Auckland school, and it's the leading case now to stop people getting name suppression. But in fact, the court never criticised the pre-conviction suppression in that case, and he had a wife who was seriously hurt by the allegations and children who were seriously hurt by the allegations. And I guess as a criminal defence lawyer, your proposition that merely being accused of something doesn't carry any true social problem, it's hugely destructive, hugely expensive. The state puts you through a system. We just look at David Bain for a split second. You know, he's put through a system that took 20 years to unravel. He loses everything. And then we say, oh, but you were only found not guilty. That doesn't prove that you're actually innocent. So we still attack you and slag you off. It's not much of a victory that the judges give you in the end by saying not guilty. So the question then is, and I can't see it in your paper, where does a kind of social or moral authority come to hurt people, to hurt the children of people charged with offences, make them cry, make children hit them at school, to have partners hurt, that kind of thing? Where is this trade-off ever attempted? Where does the state, who apparently is protective of all these people who want to read the Auckland Herald and get a bit of fun out of it, where does it attempt to weigh the people who are crying? And, for example, where in your paper do you mention the United Nations Convention on Rights of the Child, which specifically says that when making any decision about that affects children, which name suppression does, the courts have to take into account the interests of the child?
It's a bit far away from you, isn't it?
Well, when you put it in those emotional terms, Robert, I don't know that I can really respond. We have said that where it's the name of the accused that is being suppressed, the test for others connected to the accused being hurt should be extreme hardship rather than undue hardship. And that was because we in the end took the view that the threshold in relation to the name of the accused should be the same across the board. But I do concede that there is an alternative argument that is obviously, I think, a more than tenable one, which is to say that where you're talking about family members, the thresholds should be somewhat lower. I mean, people will have differing views about that, I'm sure, but it would be perfectly possible to have a test that said extreme hardship to the accused or undue hardship to others. And I think the undue hardship test would therefore address, the crying children, as you put it.
Okay, I think, can we leave it there? Thanks again, Warren, for your...